Hello everyone and welcome to the latest Brewing podcast. We've got a real treat for you today as we spend some time with Steve Eisman. Now, I know this name will be familiar to many of you, but for those that it isn't, such was his success at forecasting and navigating the US subprime crisis that his experiences formed a major part of the movie The Big Short, with his character played by Steve Carroll. Now, in today's conversation, we look at Steve's approach to investment, how he's assessing the current economic conditions and where the opportunities and risks lie, both on the long and the short side. A really insightful 25 minutes and another Brewin podcast exclusive, all of which can be enjoyed after these disclaimers.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation, which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Brewin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello everyone and welcome to the latest Brewin podcast. I'm Ben Gutteridge, Head of Fund Research, and we're delighted today to be to welcome perhaps one of the most internationally recognised investors in Steve Eisman. Steve, thank you very much indeed for taking the time to come and speak to us. A real privilege to get the opportunity to do this. I think in terms of, well, first of all, how are you? That's a rather rude start of me.
It's been a long trip.
A
little tired.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, you look well anyway, Steve.
Well, thank you.
Let's see if you can last this sort of 20, 25 minutes. I think in that time, we want to talk, I would love you to remind our listeners, I know you're pretty well recognised name, and indeed there's a movie out there if people want to understand any more about your history. But I think for the context of this conversation, we want to understand, you know, really what type of investor you are, your philosophy and process, and how that's teeing you up for your sort of positioning and the year ahead. And then we'll tackle you we'll raise some questions about some of the data and market signals of late. So let's begin with you, I guess, informing us of your sort of investment process, philosophy, and how that leads you to make investment decisions.
Well, let me just start out by saying that what I do is real traditional long-short investing.
Sure.
I pick longs, I pick shorts, I don't do pair trades. I'm trying to generate alpha on both sides all the time. These days, it's actually kind of unusual. Shorting is a little bit of a lost art. It's an art that I still do. So I think that's one differentiating factor about what I do versus what most other people do. Another differentiating factor is just that where I start...
Sorry to interrupt. I would say that analyzing some others who do long, short investing, you certainly put a number of trades down. A lot of people sort of seem to sit on their hands a bit on the short side, if not putting sort of index shorts down.
Well, I never do indices.
Yeah.
That's for wimpy people. I pick shorts and I put the individual positions on, and in some cases I'm fairly public about it. So that is also a little bit of a difference. I just don't wait around. I'm not a potted plant.
Okay. Okay, so that is what you're doing, and you're, as I said, I'll testify to your statement there that you are certainly adding value on the long and the short, and you're certainly putting money to work on both sides, unlike a lot of the competition. But clearly you have a vast experience at analysing financial markets, and I'd be sort of interested to know what it is you're looking for within the financial system, that sort of drives you to be making some overarching decisions.
So I begin the research process from a different point of origin than pretty much anybody I know. The way I like to put it is I begin in the sewage system, meaning when you cover banks for as long as I have, you become an expert in the financial system. And the financial system is really the plumbing for the economy. And it's been my experience after doing this for many, many years that things tend to show up in the plumbing a lot earlier than they show up above ground if you know where to look. And so the two things that I look at are Securitization data in the United States, which is about as broad a spectrum of credit quality data as you could find. And I combine that with credit spread data, and I put that together as like a mosaic for stress in the system. And I treat this as a green light, yellow light, red light. So if the light is green, that doesn't tell you that growth is accelerating or decelerating, or it's strong or it's not so strong. It just tells you there's no underlying stress in the system, and then you can begin the research process with a clean sheet of paper. But if it's yellow, then you don't have a clean sheet of paper. You're going to have a much more conservative type of portfolio. And that's how I start. In terms of, you know, what I look for, you know, having done financials for much of my career, now expanded over the last 4 years to doing everything, to be perfectly honest, has been a bit of a lesson in humility. I do not have one method to value companies all over planet Earth, regardless of what sector they are in. I don't believe in doing that. What I do believe is that every sector has its own mafia. These are the people, whether it's the auto mafia or the financials mafia or the tech mafia or the utilities mafia. It's amazing that there are people, all they do all day is immerse themselves in that one sector. And that mafia, regardless, whichever sector you're talking about, they don't determine stock prices, but they do what I like to say is determine the terms of debate. So they determine how people value companies in the sector, and they determine what are the important data points that people should care about. And so what I don't do is, for example, I would never have an investment idea that says, I'm short Microsoft because I think the market's been misvaluing Microsoft only for the last 40 years. That's a waste of everybody's time. I may have a thesis about Microsoft that's different than the market, and that might make it a long or a short, but I'm not going to try and force the issue in that way. So that's, I think, a little bit of a difference than some other people.
Sure, it certainly is. Now, if we could sort of return to that traffic light system on assessment of the financial system, the plumbing, is it all coming up green at the moment? I mean, certainly on the credit spreads side, we've had some relief this year. But what are your securitization signals telling you? And I guess in the round.
So the securitization data is actually quite clear. Credit is excellent. And there are no signs of deterioration, which is, given the volatility in the marketplace over the last 6 months, I think probably surprises some people. But the securitization data has been consistent throughout that there are no underlying credit issues in the United States. That's very clear.
Well, with that, but following on from your previous answer, that doesn't necessarily tee you up for just a super net long position.
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, like I said, the securitization data will only say to you, there's no real underlying stress emerging in the economy. It's not going to tell you, for example, in 2018, U.S. growth was 3.5%, and it's accelerating or decelerating. And in that sense, the securitization data is agnostic.
Okay.
If you want to then go to the next level and figure out, you know, how's the economy doing, and is it doing better or doing worse? You actually have to do research at that point. The data is just good in the sense that if the light is green, you have a clean sheet of paper that you have no bias one way or the other. And then you just begin the research process and you try and figure things out.
Okay, so given the default that we have to do some research now, then...
Yeah, we do have to do some research before we invest.
There is clearly some question marks surrounding the data. Actually, some areas, suspicious areas of, or potentially areas of weakness, even amongst some of the US data set. And also some market signals, you know, this yield curve inversion that everyone sort of seems to...
So the yield curve inversion I would take with a grain of salt.
Okay.
I have found over the last several years that this is part of what's called credit spread data.
For our listeners' clarity, yield curve inversion, my interpretation...
So yield curve inversion just means that the long end of the curve, long-term rates, is lower than short-term rates.
Yeah.
And historically, an inversion in the yield curve predicts a recession. course, as they like to say, the yield curve is probably inverted 20 times in the last 50 years, and it's predicted 20 recessions, of which there might have been three.
Sure.
So it is true that an inversion of the yield curve predicts a recession, precedes a recession. It is not true that every time the yield curve inverts, a recession follows.
Okay.
So that's just, let's put that on the table. I think, look, it's possible that a year, 2 years from now, there'll be a recession. I don't think that has anything to do with what the yield curve is currently doing. I think that this is one of the weird after effects of their existing quantitative easing. So your listeners have to remember, fixed income markets are global. You know, a global investor can buy German bonds, U.S. bonds, Italian bonds, Chinese bonds. They could buy anything. And the issue with the U.S. inversion is that because of we no longer have quantitative easing in the United States, but there still is quantitative easing in Europe. So one of the results of that, for example, is that there are negative rates in Europe, which, you know, we could talk about this forever. I don't think that's a good thing, but that's what we have. So, for example, as of last week when I last looked, the German 10-year was negative 2 basis points.
Yeah.
Well, how high can the U.S. 10-year go when it's competing with the German Bund at negative 2 basis points? There's a limit to how high we can go. That outer band is probably 3%. And so from that outer band, if there is economic data that shows that there's some sort of slowing in the economy, rates are going to go down from there. And I think the inversion of the yield curve is nothing more than that, in that rates would be higher, considerably higher, if there was no quantitative easing in Europe. But there is quantitative easing in Europe. And so our rates only got so high. And now that there is...
Without, sort of anchored by...
They're anchored by Europe.
Yeah.
And so because there is some slowing in the economy, rates are now lower from that level. And that process has produced an inversion of the yield curve because the Fed has been raising rates the last few years.
But of course, I mean, that's a very neat explanation of what's happening at the long end.
Oh, it's better than neat. Really good.
It's excellent. I apologize. But at the short end, clearly the Fed has been moving yields lower, and it would be interesting to moving rates lower. It would be interesting to get your explanation, your sense of what the explanation is there. Is it because they're concerned about international growth, European growth, or are they worried about what's happening domestically, or is it an inflation story?
So the Fed has been raising rates for the last 2 straight years.
Yeah.
And in October of last year, the head of the Federal Reserve, Powell, said things are fine and we're going to continue to raise rates. And the market said, you're an idiot. And everybody freaked out because the market was saying to itself, things are slowing, and the Fed's continuing to raise rates. And that's one of the reasons why there was a market correction in the fourth quarter of last year. So in late December or is it January of this year, the Fed basically backed down. I think the Fed backing down is nothing more than a result of the market freaking out. So in my world, they call this... You've heard of the Greenspan put,
okay,
and you've heard of the Bernanke put, and you've heard of the Yellen put. We now have the Powell put. So the last great chairman of the Federal Reserve was Volcker. And, you know, Volcker wanted to kill inflation. And so he kept raising rates. And everybody, the market was screaming. The president was screaming. Everybody was screaming, you're killing us, you're killing us. And Volcker said, I don't care that I'm killing you because I'm going to kill inflation. He was the last great Fed chairman. Everybody else takes their cues from the marketplace.
So, I mean, I do want to get on to how you're sort of seeing individual companies or sectors. But does that mean you believe the Fed is sort of getting itself, if not already, behind the curve? The U.S. economy is setting itself up for a bit of reacceleration of growth and inflation might sort of kick on?
Well, I'm not worried about inflation at all. Okay. I just think because of global trade, et cetera, the risk of inflation is about as close to zero as you could imagine. Do I think there's a possibility that growth will be stronger than people fear? I do. And then the Fed will say, if growth is stronger, maybe we should raise rates again. So that there's that yin and yang that's going to exist, I think, this year.
Okay, well, let's get into businesses then. And I guess no better place to start than the banking sector. I mean, given that relatively benign backdrop, although not quite such an exciting one on the rate side, you know, how are you assessing the banks and where to start? You know,
so we have a considerable amount of our capital in financials. The only area that we have more capital in is technology. But in financials overall, we're net short, which means I have more shorts than I have longs.
Sure.
And but we're positioned in a very regional way. So in the United States, we have some longs. They're generally large cap financials. Like one position, for example, is Citigroup. And there our thesis is, the rate environment in the United States is a negative. However, the regulatory environment in the United States has become more benign since President Trump got elected and replaced all the regulators. And so as a result, we think leverage is going to inch up slowly within the banks, and that's going to improve returns. And that's been our thesis all along, and we still think that thesis is valid. We are short a whole bunch of financials in Canada and Europe. And they're actually different stories. In Canada has had the benefit of being a very heavily commodity-oriented economy during a period that's been called the commodity super cycle, meaning commodities have gone straight up. That's over. But as a result of the commodity super cycle, Canada has not had a credit cycle in 30 years, which means that every single CEO of every bank in Canada has never seen a loss in his entire career. It's an astonishing statement to say. Our view, for various reasons, is that we're going to get a normalization of credit. This is not the Big Short Canada. I don't think Canada is going to fall into the ocean. The housing market is going to go down. It's not going to collapse. But it's going to produce losses, and that's going to mean a normalization of credit. And in that kind of environment, the Canadian banks will go down.
And, I mean, the housing market's under some strain is the sort of underpins that thesis. I mean, it's sort of well understood, there's sort of an overvaluation or perceived overvaluation in housing. But, you know, do you need a specific catalyst to?
Well, we've had a catalyst in Canada. It's working its way through the system slowly, in that the Canadian regulators changed the mortgage rules. So that today, to qualify for a mortgage in Canada, you have to qualify at 2% higher than the mortgage rate. And that's a big, so in other words, if mortgage rates in Canada are 5%, the underwriter has to be able to say that you can afford to pay a 7% mortgage. Well, there are fewer people who can afford 7% than there can afford 5%. So the universe of people who can get financing in Canada is shrinking. And that has been impacting, and we think it will continue to impact the Canadian housing market.
And sorry, there's some other areas of financials that other regions that you're cautious on?
So, no offense to your viewers, but
we have an international audience, but right, probably dominating.
But I'm sure there's a lot of viewers in Europe and in the UK.
Yeah.
So let's begin with the UK. No offense to anybody from the UK, but we're short three UK banks, not big. But we have a short position in three UK banks under the assumption that there will be some version of Brexit and soon. Now, I don't know if that's going to happen or not, but at the rate things are going, it seems like there's a higher likelihood that that will happen than there was yesterday. And under a scenario that Brexit does happen, that's not going to be a positive for the UK economy, and then therefore not a positive for the banks. Our shorts in Europe are, they're each their own story, but there is kind of one overarching theme in that European banks are generally just not that well run. They're much more levered than U.S. banks. Their returns are lower, significantly lower than U.S. banks. And the regulators in Europe, unlike the regulators in the U.S., are still in the process of forcing the European banks to delever. And anybody who knows how banks work is that when a bank is delevering, profitability suffers.
Well, I certainly don't know how well how banks work relative to you, but there's a couple of arguments on the bull side for Europe. One is sort of stand out, I guess, valuations, but you won't be sort of lured into that trap just yet, or would you sort of consider taking
valuation is not my god.
Yeah.
It's important, but if fundamentals are deteriorating fundamentals will I think trump a cheap valuation every time. I can't see how European bank fundamentals could improve unless all of a sudden, for some reason that I don't know, the European economy improves dramatically, which, given what's going on in Europe and in the UK these days, is hard to believe.
Well, I mean, on the fundamental side, I mean, there is some evidence that perhaps French and German bank lending is picking up, and maybe the problem is Italian banking, and Italian banking lending has been, you know, dramatically clipped as a result of the EU-Italian coalition standoff. That seems to have abated. Maybe there's scope for improvements in Italian bank lending going forward. I know perhaps a bit of a moonshot, optimistic, but...
that would be a bit of a moonshot.
So you just, you're on the fundamental side, I mean, you're
I
still...
I don't see any improvement in European... And the thing, again, as long as European regulators... And they're not doing this in the press. What you see is every single time one of the European banks reports, they'll say something like, you know, last time we spoke to you, we thought we needed an 11% capital ratio, but now we realize it's 11.5, and they show up the next quarter and they say 12, and the next quarter they say 12.5. As long as that process continues, just the way the math works, a higher capital ratio is the same thing as saying the bank is delevering.
Yeah.
And just the way the math works, a bank that is delevering will have lower profitability, period, hard stop.
Okay, well, on that definitive end, let's move to one quick, we'll briefly spend a bit of time on other areas of the market that you look at, and then we'll round out. I mean, as you said, your biggest capital allocation is to
technology.
It'd be interesting to have some explanation behind that.
So I won't pretend to be the world's leading expert on every technology stock. Yeah, I would be the first, but I'm not a member of the tech mafia. However, I think...
And interestingly, rather modestly, you didn't sort of announce yourself as part of the financials mafia.
Well, I am a member of the Sharpe financials mafia. That's a given. You know, you can't be a member of more than one or two mafias because there's not enough hours in the day that you could spend to be able to become a member in every mafia. It's impossible. But one thing I've noticed about tech, which allows me to sort of remove some of the noise, is that if you line up all the companies for the last 20 years that have, let's call it, gone to glory, you know, the Apples of the world, Microsoft, Facebook, Google, they all do different. I mean, they're all technically tech companies, but they all do different things. So what do they have in common? They actually have one thing in common. They're all oligopolies. Amazon, Google, Facebook, Microsoft, Amazon, on and on and on, they all have that in common. Why is that important? Because oligopolies, the thing that people focus on in tech is always growth. And oligopolies have far more durable business models than people who don't operate in oligopolies. So when looking for longs, I immediately narrow the entire universe just to the companies that are oligopolistic, and then I analyze them. That narrows the universe considerably. You know, the problem with investing in a company that doesn't have an oligopolistic feel to it in tech is, I mean, take for example, internet security. Some of these are great companies. But the problem is that they're not oligopolies. And so you could wake up one day, and this happens in tech all the time, is you're investing in a company that's in a subsector that's really hot and the stock's doing great. And then out comes an announcement, Amazon's getting into the area, or Microsoft is getting into the area, et cetera, et cetera. And then all of a sudden you realize, wow, the company that I own is vulnerable. And that happens all the time. And so to minimize my risk in tech, I narrow the world to the companies that have the durable business models, which are all oligopolies. And that's how I approach tech.
And The other thing I wanted to sort of ask you is that although you've given a very clear explanation of the areas of the market you like and dislike, I mean, clearly we're operating in quite an interesting time in markets. Fourth quarter was a pretty savage drawdown. We've had a very sort of smart recovery. Mm-hmm. You know, you have the flexibility. I don't know whether you would say it's as a result of the opportunities you find long and short, but you can be sort of more exposed to market moves than less. It'd be interesting to know whether you are sort of wanting putting more money to work as a result of taking market risk, or whether you're nervous about markets at large.
I think the fourth quarter was a lesson in the negative. One of the negative impacts of what quantitative easing. There's no question that the fourth quarter data showed a slowing economy. But the way the market reacted, it reacted as if we were about to enter a financial crisis yesterday. So what I'm saying is the decline in the market in the fourth quarter was way out of proportion to the data. And so the question is why? And I think the answer is that what quantitative easing does is central banks go out and buy things like government bonds, et cetera, which in my world is called risk-free assets. And by central banks going out and buying risk-free assets in the trillions, it means that people like you and me and your viewers can't buy those same risk-free assets because the government, the federal central banks, own it. And so as a result, and this was intentional, central banks have forced everybody to take more risk in their portfolios. That's just de facto what happened. Now, people have made a lot of money being forced out on the risk curve. But on some level, they're not comfortable. And they're not comfortable because they didn't go out on the risk curve willingly. They were forced to. And so what happens periodically, and this has happened twice now because people forget already. Remember January, February 2016, when the market went to a tailspin because oil prices were going down. And people interpret that as a slowing economy, which turned out not to be true. And now, in the end of 2018, you had a similar event because of a different data set. And I think what periodically happens is something happens, whether oil prices go down, or maybe the third quarter results aren't as good as people expected, and because the investing world is not comfortable with the kind of risk it is actually taking, people freak out. And I think this kind of volatility is probably here to stay as long as we live in some version of a quantitative easing world.
So in that environment, probably long short managers, you might say, would be
a reason. I think over time, it'll be better. You'll have more stable returns. I don't try and swing for the fences, but I think over time, you get a better return.
Okay, well, Steve, it's been a real honor to speak to you. So thanks very much for showing such energy in the midst of a long trip. And on behalf of the UK Wealth Management Fund Research Mafia, may I thank you for your time. To our listeners, thanks very much for listening. Let us know what you think on Twitter, referencing hashtag Bruin Podcast, or leave a review on iTunes or SoundCloud. But until next time, many thanks for listening.